Bristol, For the Record, a new local oral history podcast from BCFM Radio in partnership with MShed Bristol and funded by the National Lottery Heritage Fund.
The legendary Lakota nightclub in Stotescroft, once deemed in the early 90s as one of the most famous clubs in the country outside London, opened on the 7th of June 1992 during the heady days of the rave scene. One of the owners, Marty Burgess, is also a successful lawyer, as well as being a prominent figure for a number of local organisations, including the Bristol Beacon, the Society of Merchant Venturers, and Black South West Network. Hello, Marty.
Hi.
So, why are nightclubs important spaces?
Well, first and foremost, I guess they're a place where people can enjoy themselves. I mean, I like dancing and find it very relaxing, and I think any space which allows people to listen to music and dance is good, but also it kind of, they nurture talent, particularly if you're a club like Lakota where you focus on what is underground music. It's a chance for people to be, particularly local people, to be given opportunities to test out what they're doing and hopefully go on to have a really good career in music.
Can you describe the Bristol rave and nightclub scene now and in the past in your eyes?
Yeah, it's a difficult one, really, because, I mean, I'd probably be able to describe the 90s better because I'm now quite old and I don't really go out clubbing to other clubs. I sometimes go to Lakota. I spend a lot of time in my kitchen dancing to music with my friends and in their kitchen dancing to music. And so I'm probably not that good on what's going on now. But in the 90s, early 90s particularly, I moved back to Bristol from uni, and my mum and dad had a nightclub which was pretty successful called the Tropic Club, which was kind of downstairs was student music and upstairs was sort of funk and soul and reggae. And it was a successful club, but there weren't many places in the early 90s which were as mixed as that, and there was definitely not any big spaces playing sort of electronic music or rave music as it was then. You had a bit at places like Thekla, and there was another boat on the docks, which also probably the first acid house rave I went to, can't remember what it's called, but there weren't many big spaces doing that sort of music. You had all the clubs sort of Park Street in the centre, and which were kind of weren't that welcoming to black people. You know, I remember going to clubs and being turned away. I once went to what is now SWX, I think it's called, but it was then, I think, Papillon's. And I went with my mum to go and see something and we got turned away. And not really any explanation given. So kind of what we were trying to do at Lakota, and it wasn't just us, it was across the country, was serving the audience of ravers, which were looking at people who just wanted to go out clubbing. They weren't really, you know, whatever background you were from, you could go to Lakota. And it was kind of just captured that whole scene, which was kind of like quite an inspirational, I think, still think it's inspirational in terms of that it was just focused on music and focused on it. What there wasn't any, you know, it didn't matter what colour you were, whether you were gay, I don't know, trans or anything, it was just very welcoming.
Interesting you say that. So how would you describe the scene then to now? Have things got better, worse, the same?
Well, Bristol's completely changed. I mean, back then we were doing predominantly house music and different types of it. Like there was techno, there was more the disco end of house, and there was the harder end. But, you know, Bristol's a bass city now, and I think that's the difference. The real big difference in terms of music is that sort of late 90s, early noughties, bass music just took over. Because, I mean, we had to adjust our business model to adopt this new sound, which, you know, to some extent, Bristol's had a huge impact because we had lots of good artists came out of Bristol. But in terms of the sort of the diversity dynamics, I think things have only got better across the piece, but clubs like Lakota haven't really changed. We were doing, you know, we were being diverse at a point when it wasn't even talked about. We were doing that because that's what we wanted to go out to. I mean, we were a really mixed bunch of people, you know, amongst the close-knit group of people who kind of put on the events at Lakota. So we were kind of just wanting a place to create a space that was comfortable. At the time, one of the people who worked for us was called Tyrone, and he was a Brummie, sort of similar background to me, Jamaican background, liked to dress up in women's clothes, was very gay, and was HIV positive. And we always used to say that we didn't want to do anything where Tyrone didn't feel comfortable, and that was kind of our litmus test. If Tyrone couldn't feel comfortable there, then why would we want to do any event? And so, you know, that's the early 90s. We've always been like that. So it's just, if anything, we've kind of got, I guess, if anything, where we were probably not as diverse as we could have been was really that that early days of bass music in Bristol. We weren't even in that space because we were all into rave house music. So I think that's probably where we were in late 90s, early noughties. We were playing catch up because it was a scene that was underground that we hadn't really grasped. And I remember at the moment where I was kind of shamed by Ronnie Size into booking him. We did an event with Radio 1, where it was a panel show at Lakota, talking about music and Bristol music. And Ryan then called us out and said he had never played at Lakota. And it was kind of like, it's a kind of amusing thing. We're really good friends. And it was one of those moments where, like, why the hell isn't he playing at Lakota? We were so focused on getting these big American DJs. And we had the scene being developed in Bristol. And then the year after that, he went on to win the Mercury Music Prize. And I only booked him as a result of being called out. So, yeah, that's a long answer.
How did you end up running one of Bristol's most well-known nightclubs? Can you describe your journey to how you became one of the owners?
My parents had a nightclub, so we were in, you know, I used to work at the Tropic Club from an early age. We were like, you know, I used to DJ there when I was about 17. Mum and dad used to, me and my brother used to do the bar and I used to do the DJ. And so kind of was nightclubs was part of my personal DNA. But when I went to uni in London, I just got really into going out clubbing, the first sort of big clubs I went to in London, to go to the Fridge, to Soul to Soul. And then we all, as a group of friends, we all got involved, caught up. And this is like late 80s when I went to uni, we all got caught up in the rave scene. And it was just something that I was genuinely and honestly into the music. And then in the late 90s, early 90s, Bentley, my brother, who was back in Bristol, kind of was really pushing mum and dad to do something which was rave orientated because of, you know, the scene was exploding everywhere, and his friendship group, the same, were sort of saying that this, you know, this is the next big thing. And we bought the buildings behind the Tropic Club, turn into a rave venue. And then George, who owned the Moon Club, which was down the road, had also done the same thing. He'd bought the buildings next door, and it just so happens he couldn't afford to develop his buildings out. And that's how we ended up getting involved with his nightclub, was because there didn't seem a point in doing both. And he was running out of money, so rather than spend the money on our building, we spent the money on his building. And Bentley went into partnership with him. 1994, I started working there. I finished uni in 92, came back to Bristol and started working in the promotions team at Lakota alongside a guy called Tintin, who used to do a night called Cooker. It was a jazz. So when Lakota first opened, it was every other weekend, every other Saturday was jazz. And then in between that, it was kind of house music and just other things. And so I started working in the promotions team. I was booking acts for a couple of house nights there. And then in 94, so there was 2 years of the partnership arrangement, George unfortunately had a brain hemorrhage, and prior to us getting involved with him, he'd taken on a lot of debt and hadn't paid it. So the banks pulled the rug from underneath the whole business. And that's the point where Bentley and I bought the Lakota. We were there. But the other bidders were people who owned a nightclub in London called the Hanover Grand, and or SW1, I think they had at the time. And they went on to do Poonanar chain and various other sort of shishi clubs that the Royal family go to. But they were the other bidders and we outbid them. And that's how we ended up owning it ourselves. So we've owned it since 94. In the late 90s, I did toy the idea of selling Lakota, and we came really close to selling it to the Poonanar group. And part of the reason was we'd kind of overexpanded too quickly. The record label was doing really well, but we needed more money to invest in it, and we were going to sell ourselves and work for them. And when they sent their surveyors down, so that all the deal was negotiated, the lawyers had been at it for ages. ages, and then they sent a surveyor down and he pulled the plug on the deal because he said that it was in he didn't understand why they were interested in this place because it's in the deepest bandit country. And when we read that report, we were like, we just couldn't understand it. And it was just a case of it just shows the, you know, because I love St Paul's, and it's just, call it deepest bandit country, I just thought was just bizarre, and it was fundamentally racist. Yeah, and that's why our deal didn't happen. And there's a little bit of regret in it, but in the sense that it would have changed our trajectory. But Poonam and Awa did go bust about 4 years later, and so yeah, the last laugh was on us. So yeah, there you go.
The building of Lakota, what was it before it became a nightclub?
It's a very old building, the 1860s. It was, bizarrely, a bottling works, which was, it was part of the old Stokescroft Brewery. We also own the building next door, which is, we call it the Coroner's Court, because it was the Coroner's Court for a number of years. But prior to it being a Coroner's Court, it was a Wesleyan school, and Wesleyans are anti-alcohol. So it's really interesting that they, and that's, is later than the Lakota building. They built Temperance School next to the remains of a brewery, and maybe it was to influence people who drank too much. But even before then, it's just got a really interesting history, that whole area. So Backfields, which is where Lakota's slap bang in the middle of, used to be the part of town where travelling circuses and fairgrounds and equivalent things, like if you were into bear baiting and all these odd things, that's where they used to come and set up, and people used to visit to see those things. It's always been a place known as sort of, fun and debauchery.
The freaks and geeks,
yeah.
Now, Lakota, over the years, has not just been a nightclub, has it? It's been a record label, it's been a DJ agency, a shop. Can you tell us more about those different...
Yeah, we did lots of different things, but we lost money on pretty much all of those, apart from the record label. The record label didn't lose money. It ran out of steam, but it also put us... So, kind of in the 90s, it was... we were young and we were just experimenting. So we did lots of other things because we travelled around a lot and went to the States and kind of saw what else was going on. And we did all those things. I think perhaps we were hampered by who we were. We didn't get any investment, and the record label did make money. But in order to have taken it to the next level, we needed a lot of investment, and we didn't get any. And we knocked on a lot of doors. And we didn't get any. And so, yeah, it was one of those things. I mean, it's kind of the shop was just, it was looking for somewhere to sell tickets. And, yeah, we did a lot of things. That the shop definitely lost a lot of money. And what was the other thing we did? Management. DJ agency. That was okay. We were kind of looking after our own artists, and other artists. But what happened was, obviously, we were a small outfit in Bristol, and our most successful artist in the late 90s was an artist called Timo Maas, and he got signed by Perfecto. So I blame myself. So I went on tour with Paul Oakenfold to South Africa, and I gave him Timo Maas's record, which was out on our label, and then he nicked him, he signed him. So we lost our biggest artist.
Oh, sad story.
Sad story, yeah. I could say a lot more about what I think of Paul Oakenfold, but I'll save that for when we're offline.
So Lakota Nightclub has just celebrated 30 years in the game. What have been some of the highs and lows during that time?
Loads of highs. I mean, if you're into dance music like I am, then lots of highs. I mean, we had loads of gigs with people like Roger Sanchez. I'm really into American House, not above anything else, but that was my thing in the 90s, was the American House. And we had some absolutely fantastic gigs with people like Roger Sanchez and, just other big Americans we brought over. It cost a lot of money, but it was just musically, it was kind of taken up to another level. Things like Della Soul gig we did in the 90s, kind of at that point in their career where they'd had their big moment and were kind of in between, and we booked them. And I know they say they credit that was one of their things, knowing that they still had a massive audience, because it was just like it was just like a complete roadblock, and it was just I know other people say it was one of the best parties ever at Lakota, because it felt like a party, and they had a really good time. Kind of some of the early gigs were kind of set us on the path. We had Sasha October 92, and that was when really we realized that how big that scene was. I mean, our capacity was about 600 maybe even 800 at that point, but we could have filled the club like 4 or 5 times over. And so yeah, you just remember stuff like that. We were sat in the office, and my office was on the second floor, and we were sat in the office that night, and then we just heard a tap on the window, and somebody had climbed up the building to try and get in, and that's how crazy it was. And then just little things, you always have highlights. Like a couple of years ago, we had Dave Morales play. We tried to get him in the 90s, and he wouldn't play. We went all the way up to Cream in Liverpool to try and speak to him, to convince him to play, and he just made some really flippant comment like, "Bristol, I've never heard of it, I'm not going there." In an American accent. But when he came over a few years ago, we went out for dinner with him. He was really nice, and we had a really good event. Other highlights, because when Lakota first opened, had jazz every other week, so there was lots of big jazz artists. Roy Ayres, Jamiroquai played twice, 92 93. Yeah, lots of highlights. And recent highlights, I went a couple of weekends ago for an Ibiza Classics night, and I went with my daughter and had a really good time. So I just like it. So I could reel off the highlights. All the early Ronnie Size, when he played, all of those were just, they were massive, in the sense that you really, because prior to sort of the whole Ronnie Size era, we were an importer of other people's sounds. And that was where actually it really felt like we were doing something which was local. And we're kind of where we are, we have lots of residents now, and we had always had residents back in those days, but you know, Bristol wasn't known for house music in terms of production, and it's only really that whole Ronnie Size era, and you know, all DJ Di and all those people, where we started making our own music, which was having national and international impact. In fact, I went to I think about the year they won the Mercury's, we all went to Miami, and we were met up with all the represent guys and went out with them, and you just knew from that, just we walked into the Delano Hotel where everyone was at the Miami Music Conference, and you could tell just by the way the whole crowd just reacted to that, them moving, that they were on that trajectory to being massive. Yeah, does that answer special moments? Not even special moments at Lakota, but that day we went for that happened with Ronnie Size, and then we went to a Masters at Work gig with Roy Ayres, and we were all just like the little Bristol posse, all just dancing. And whenever Ryan and I talk, we always say that was one of our best days out ever, because it was just like, yeah, just I don't know, if Bristol posse in Miami having it.
Bristol in the house. What have been some of the challenges and difficulties of running a nightclub?
Kind of the sort of being up against it, in terms of you feel like you're under the cosh. The police were kind of very, we were very hated by the police. And you know, we got raided, all sorts of things. And when we got raided, they interviewed all the staff. They just wanted to find the smoking gun, which was that we were black drug dealers rather than black club owners. That was quite, you know, the whole of the 90s felt like we were under a lot of like siege mentality, and it kind of to some extent probably made us really tough, but siege mentality, because we were always being like, the council was always on us, the police were always on us, fire safety people were always on us. So that side of things been tough. And also just money, just not, you know, we were young. I was 24 when we bought Lakota. We were inexperienced. We'd never really done a business plan, cash flow. And kind of like when we started expanding into all the other stuff, we just ran out of money. And that the end of the 90s was really a moment for us to kind of turn it into a business. And when you turn something like Lakota into a business, you kind of have to do the stuff you don't like as much. And there was a moment in the noughties when in order to survive, we had to do a lot of events, which I wouldn't have done if it was just down to me, but we had to do it to survive, because by the early noughties, all of this mainstream clubs had kind of come into our space and were booking the DJs we were booking. Talk about Paul Oakenfold. The first time he played at Lakota was paid him £500. And by the early noughties, we were quoted some like 10 grand for him to play.
Wow.
And so we couldn't afford that. So, but the clubs, like the bigger clubs, the mainstream ones, were prepared to pay that. So we kind of had to adapt our business model. And because we were behind on the whole bass scene, we were not seen as the home of bass. You know, it was a place like Trinity here, you know, Eastern Community Centre. You see some absolutely brilliant nights, which were at that early part. So kind of people weren't that keen to play at our venue until we had to do a lot of work to get them in, and we had to do a lot of events which were kind of, I would say, sort of lowest common denominator events within the rave scene in order just to survive. And that's what you just have to do when it's, and then it becomes less of a labour of love, it just becomes a business.
So you described how it's been precarious sometimes for Lakota. Also, there's been issues with licensing reviews as well.
Yep.
Also, I've heard maybe it was going to be turned into flats at one point. Did you want to tell us more?
The licensing reviews is nothing unusual. We've just had one recently, which is kind of really frustrating that we, you know, you get one a resident complainant who's moved into the area, you know, moved into the area, I don't know, 10 years ago or however long, but we've been there 30 years. But because of the way the law works, she's got a voice, she can make a complaint, and she complained about was a event we did on Stokes Croft, and somebody else set up a sound system on Portland Square where she lives, and we were under review for an event that happened on Portland Square, which was nothing to do with us. But, and it just means, it's just frustrating because that's the way the system works. You know, people can make complaints. People can move in next to a nightclub, complain about it. I mean, there are some protections under Angel of Change, but I just don't understand people who moved to a nightclub and complain. It's a very odd thing. And then, what was the other half of the question?
The
development hub, yeah. The big question. We've got planning permission, so we just want to keep our options open. We've got planning permission, so we could turn it into flats if we wanted to. At the moment, we don't want to, so we're continuing to run our nightclub. At some point in the future, maybe us. More likely to be the kids. When we've stopped raving and we're in the grave, they'll have the option to do that.
So Stokes Croft, the area, has changed so much over the years. It seemed at one point it was a place like a no-go area. Now it's the area where everybody wants to go and live. How has that impacted on the club? You've just mentioned one there, people moving in. Anything else?
It's another interesting one. So back in the sort of 80s when I was young, my parents had a nightclub up the road, and it was, there was Moses, which is now... called something like Bristol Cellar. I can't remember what it's called. Anyway, across the road from the Tropic Club was a club called Mozart's, and there were Slicks, which also used to kind of do a bit of post-clubbing, sort of after-party type of thing. And that, you'd walk out on a Saturday night and it would feel like you were in a black high street, and it didn't feel like a no-go area to me. It might have felt like it to other people, but it was pretty damn cool. And you know, if anything, that's been, and there was so much other stuff as well. You know, there was some Blue Mountain down the road, there was Ajax's around the corner, and you could feel like you could go out in and around St Paul's on Montpellier, and, you know, it wasn't just black people, but there was a lot of black music being enjoyed by people of all colours. And so, if anything, a lot of the people who like to say they want to keep Stokes Croft as it is are people who've come along and changed it. I mean, eras evolve, and we're fortunate that we've been able to hold on to our bit of it, and we're going to continue to do so. I mean, if anything, I mean, eras just evolve. I'm not one of those who think that things should stay as they are, because, and particularly, you know, the voiceless have had the era change on them already. So, yeah. Does that answer your question?
Perfect. Yeah. Perfect. And in more recent years, we've had COVID, pandemic, the lockdown. How did that impact on Lakota?
Weirdly, we had a really good pandemic because we were fortunate, we have an outside space, so we were able to, and we pivoted you know, using pandemic terminology, we pivoted quite early. We opened up on the first day that you could do, and we opened a outside an outdoor venue, you know, 6 meters, everything table 6 meters apart. We had, again, loads of hassle from the council. I want to say hassle. On one side, we had lots of people within the council who were really keen on what we were going to do, what we wanted to do. But then we had the licensing people who misinterpreted the coronavirus regulations and which affected other people, why many others didn't open. We interpreted it in the correct way and said we're going to open, and we did. We just did. We read the regulations, worked with the NTIA, which is a sort of national organisation lobbying on behalf of nightclubs. And because we were out of the traps early, we had a successful summer. And I loved when we were doing that, the sit-down clubbing, because it's great for people who are old and dodgy knees. And we just we just did really good stuff because we were just experimenting. It felt like it was one of, you know, out of any crisis, there's sometimes opportunities. And I think Lakota is one of those. We thrive on that. We thrive on someone's throwing us a curveball and trying to work out what to do and how to deal with it. And yeah, I had some, in terms of when we talked about highlights earlier, some of the most recent highlights are those events in the pandemic. We had loads, we did lots of different, we had comedy, we had music, we had sort of house music, we did jazz. And again, it was just, just felt like a good time in terms of doing something different. And there was no late, because I am quite a stress person, and I stress out most Saturday nights when the coast is open, particularly in the, when the new students are here and they're really vulnerable, don't really know their limits. I don't sleep very well. Whereas when the pandemic was on, the club was closed by 10:30. So I had a year and a half of very good sleep.
I guess before we go on to the final question about how you see the future of nightclub and rave scene in Bristol, just from the top of your head, can you think of any other funny anecdotes, interesting stories that have happened over the years to jump out at you?
I told you I'm not very funny. Let me think, things that are funny. There's so much, there's loads of things happened. I mean, I could tell you like loads of embarrassing stories about people when they're off the head, but that's not really very fair. I know that all like the things like with one of the things that, you know, like all the American DJs, and if I meet someone like Roger Sanchez now, they all talk about, they love the fact that we were black owned. You know, they used to come and they used to find out, you know, when they realised that they could eat curry goat and jerk chicken, we used to have a little kitchen in Lakota because you had to under licensing laws, and that was quite nice. And that was one of the things that they used to go back and tell other people about. Oh, it's a black owned club and you can get you can eat Jamaican food. And you know that that's not really that funny. That's just an anecdote.
How do you see the future of the nightclub and rave scene in Bristol?
I think generally it's in a good place in terms of the fact that we can sustain so many. I mean, a few years ago when new places were opening, you know, and when Motion opened, it was like people talked about, oh, Motion, that's going to be the death of Lakota, and it just hasn't been. And you know, we can have events where we're busy, Motion's busy, all the small venues are a bit busy. So if anything, it just shows that how strong this club scene is in Bristol. And you know, it is helped by the students, absolutely 100%. But also over the summer with the sort of all the day parties and things like that, and also other things coming through where people feel strong enough to do stuff. We had an event with some young ladies in an event early this summer, which is kind of like an experiment for us in the gardens. And yeah, it was good, you know, an event where pretty much the audience was, I would say, probably one of the most mixed audience we've had for a long time. And yeah, so I feel confident. There's obviously loads of headwinds, you know, the whole energy thing. I mean, that really panics me, how much it's going to cost to do what we do. So come next month or so, next week or so, we'll find out what the government, if they're going to help, and then we'll find out in the next month or so what the fee charges are going to be. But yeah, and then, you know, the economy, that anyone, when they talk about negativity in the economy, it worries you. But we've kind of been through it for 30 years. We've been through recessions already. In fact, we opened during a recession. And I always think that at times like this is where creativity, because people will want to, you know, hard times leads to people to think. Thinking leads to creativity, and creativity manifests itself in new music and all of that. So I kind of never feel negative about stuff, but you kind of got to be conscious that things like the cost of living will impact on the amount of people, money people have to spend. So yeah, but it is worrying times, but I feel like we're strong. I mean, we as a business were pretty strong, having been through loads of shit before, but I think the scene in Bristol's pretty resilient.
And how do you see the rave scene and nightclubs in the country in general?
It's so hard because I listen to the radio and I always listen to new music and stuff. I don't really know what goes on. I go to other cities, they're so different. I mean, I go out in Manchester, everyone dresses up and you can't get in if you look scruffy. It's just so different, you know, whereas you in Bristol, if you dress up, if you want to go and see dressed up people, you have to go to places like the Ivy. Whereas most people, Bristol's quite a cat. I mean, look how scruffy I am today. Most of us are quite scruffy. We're not. So I just think it's hard to compare. You know, I do think in Bristol what we've got is something quite unique in that it's different and that is developed differently from other cities, and then going out in Bristol is very different. So when you've travelled around and gone to other places, yeah, you can see, oh, this has got a bit of a Bristol feel. But I don't go to Manchester and think, oh, this feels like, oh, this is, we should take what they've done here and bring it home back to Bristol, because I just think we're different cities. I mean, I love Liverpool, and that's a city I've always liked to go in clubbing in, and but it's very different from here, you know, really different. And so I don't know, is the answer.
Marty Burgess, thank you so much for your time.
No problem.